Hey, what's up? I want to get straight to the point, cut to the chase. How do you imagine your own success? What does it feel like? What does it look like? Can you taste it? How deeply can you imagine it? And with that being said, how do you imagine your wealth? You know, we spend a lot of time thinking about things like, you know, job security and such, but what about food security too? Chances are, like me, you're probably well fed at this very moment and don't pay much attention to this quite often. But what if the day came that you did have to pay attention to where your food's coming from? Like as in, you don't know where you're going to get your next meal. You know, you might resonate with the idea of creating a successful agricultural business that provides for yourself and for your family in ways that are far more rewarding than just money. So I have for you a summary of an invaluable roadmap rooted in decades of wisdom with good, solid advice on how to exactly make this dream a reality. So let's see what Joel Salatin has to say on the subject with his book, Your Successful Farm Business. Bom dia, buenos dias, welcome to Eco Village Library. I'm your host, Christopher Kinney, and I'm here to summarize for you great works being produced within the wonderful world of sustainable living, resiliency, eco village, community living, you name it. My background is in sustainable development engineering, and most of my working and learning years have been spent with small farming communities throughout the Americas. I have just finished rereading an all-time favorite book of mine, Your Successful Farm Business by Joel Salatin, which was written to be an extension of his earlier book, You Can Farm, and hence refers to this book as being, you know, the graduate's level course. I highly enjoyed reading through this all again because I feel that it is a very honest and real assessment of what really to expect and what to prepare for when starting your own agricultural venture. So what can you expect then as you plunge into the depths of the entrepreneurial path? Is it really like chewing glass and staring into the eyes of the abyss, as Elon Musk would describe it? Well, after working on farms throughout the Americas and Europe, it was definitely clear to me that there is much more to being a successful farm that goes beyond just milking cows and picking vegetables. A lot to it goes beyond the physical. It demands spirit. But it's also perhaps the most holistic profession one can ever take on. And it's not only a profession, but a life choice as well. This aspect is the most enamoring to me, as Joel has said it so well. The worst day on the farm is better than the best day fighting traffic, confined in a cubicle and attached to electronic devices. By being involved in the world of agriculture, you inevitably choose to immerse yourself more intimately with life itself. You know, as a farmer, you will inevitably find yourself working as, you know, a mechanic, marketer, accountant, agronomist, builder, electrician, nutritionist, community leader, and the list goes on. What's also special about this vocation is that you develop such a dynamic and interactive relationship with the landscape and its ecology that you inevitably become what Joel Salatin describes as the grand masseuse of the earth, and must thereby view it as your patient. He says, perhaps no issue is more fundamental than the idea that farmers must interact with the landscape to participate with its succession and to develop it into something that doesn't look like it if it were abandoned. Now, just like with our own selves, it's a never-ending work in progress. You, just like the land, is either evolving or degrading. It all depends on the choices you make. Now, Joel Salatin was actually the first figurehead to open my eyes and spirit to the world of farming. I happened to pop in one night on documentary night my friends were having at college, and they were happening to watch Food Inc., which pretty much force-fed me the red pill on the spot as it showcased the horrors of factory farming and all that. Anyway, Joel Salatin spoke a lot in that film, and he also was featured in another one I watched shortly after called Fresh, which was actually the one that really got me riled up into wanting to participate into agriculture myself. So years later, I actually got to meet Joel Salatin. I shook his hand and everything. I went to see him give a lecture in Los Angeles about, you know, starting a business, which he basically laid out the same principles as outlined in this book. Now, after myself being immersed in organic agriculture for several years now, I can totally say that this guy operates and teaches from a level of mastery I've never seen before. He's got many other books under his belt and has built up an incredible farming enterprise from scratch. So with that said, let's go ahead and dive into the juicy details about how to create your own successful agricultural business. Now, supposing that we find ourselves with the responsibility of managing a raw piece of land, we need to run through a list of adjustments before we can begin. We'll have to first look at dwelling, fencing, water, buildings, and clearing unwanted vegetation. So, looking at dwelling first, we have to know where we are going to live. You know, I'm a big fan of starting out with a temporary dwelling unit, such as a yurt or a movable tiny home. This way, you'd be able to deeply observe the land and all its days of the year before making any permanent decisions in design. Now, how would we be moving in and out and all about? Just remember that whatever you can't access will be off the management table. If there are already pathways, then chances are they have been placed in a pretty good location already. But let's assume that we need to build an access way from scratch. Most important to keep in mind is to keep water away off the road at all times, because you can later find yourself with potholes that may result from puddles and water not being able to flow off and away. So to help make this happen from the get-go, it's best to avoid riding a ridge or to go through a valley. Just think and visualize how a monster rainstorm will flow over the land. You know, during my time studying civil engineering, without the aid of animation or other kind of nifty visual aids, I had to rely a lot on my visual imagination in order to comprehend incredibly difficult concepts from classes I was taking, like fluid dynamics and mechanics of materials and so on. And I suggest that when taking charge of construction projects involved with your business, imagine the progression of all the elements over the course of time and how it affects what you're focusing on. Your informed imagination could be far better than the most stimulating visual aid. Trust it and sit with it as you learn to think and imagine long and deep. As for proven techniques that involve building your access way, I highly recommend Googling broad-based dips and water bars for roads. And look at what comes up in the images tab. These will show you, you know, the kind of shapes that you would want to give your road so that water can just keep on flowing its merry way. The goal is to keep it off, always. Joel describes these strategies in awesome detail and further recommends more experts on the subject, like Darren Doherty and his company Regrarians from Australia. You know, I really like the strategy he mentions of a pond road construction, where the road you build ends up serving as a, you know, dual purpose dam. You know, I saw this being done on a property in Portugal, and although it can be quite the project, it really does save you on space and time, as you know, kill two birds with one stone. So later we'll get into why having ponds too is such a great idea. But next we'll have to think about fencing. Why? Because fences are the foundation of control. Joel says, even if you don't have any farm animals just yet, you'll still need them, you know, from protection from deer, rodents, rowdy teenagers, Nazi zombies, etc. I've stayed on many farms and ranches within deer territory that, you know, everyone seemed to have major issues keeping deer away from eating their crops. You know, when I worked with Puuhoku Ranch in Molokai, Hawaii, I remember this pit bull that lived with us who would ruthlessly chase down any deer that dared to get close. You know, and they especially liked our banana trees, you know, and they'll come in at night and, you know, make their noise. They were axis deer brought in from India. They, you know, at night they would be like, woo, woo. And this wasn't like having, you know, talking about this dog. It wasn't having like, you know, having this old farm dog having a fun time chasing around the animals. No. This one in particular was at war. He would run down every single deer showing no mercy. Every time the deer would get too fatigued, and so he would eventually catch up with them, and it would all just get very ugly from there. You know, the local Hawaiians always did the dirty work of putting the deer out of its misery, till one time I was the only one around harvesting bananas, you know, with my machete, with my lovely Luzmar alongside with me. And you know, I need to warn you that this is going to be very graphic. So feel free to skip forward, you know, a minute if you want to avoid that kind of thing. But anyway, since we're talking about creating a living that's intimately connected with life, I figure this to be appropriate since you can unwillingly find yourself in any kind of situation. So, you know, we're there harvesting bananas. It's just like any other day, bright, you know, sunshine and hearing the birds. And then you just hear, rah, 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 rah. But then just, you know, oh my God, we're like, I already knew what was going down. And then before you know it, you know, within a couple minutes, you hear the deer, like, rah, rah, you know, pinned down in one place. I'm like, oh man. So, you know, I'm just waiting to, you know, see, you know, some of the Hawaiians rushed to the scene, but nobody was around. It was just me and Luz. And so, man, what else could I have done? You know, when you're there, you know, and the animal just crying, you know, it had its shoulder ripped out from the dog's mouth. And so, you know, we rushed up to the scene and, oh God, it was down, pinned down on the ground. I couldn't get up. You know, the dog was there just with, you know, with the blood dripping down from his mouth. I'm like, oh geez. And, you know, I just had the machete I was using to, you know, harvest the bananas. And, you know, there was just no other choice, but you know, you guessed it. You know, I had to go up, you know, straddle the deer suffering, and just, you know, took my machete. And, oh, I'm so sorry. And I had to whack away, and the deer was, you know, oh man, it felt so, it, you know, expect to find yourself in a situation like that, because I, you know, I thought I was just going to be harvesting bananas that day, but, you know, little did I know, I was hacking away at a old poor deer with an old machete. So, and eventually, you know, it was funny because, you know, Luzmar, the day earlier, we were, you know, talking about, you know, the rooster that they wanted to get rid of on the ranch. It was causing a lot of trouble, since they're like, you know, they offered for us, you know, the Hawaiians offered for us to kill it and eat it for dinner. And so, you know, I thought about it and talked it over with Luz, and, you know, she had a hard time digesting that part of it, and, you know, started crying. And it's like, okay, no, we won't do this. We'll be vegetarians here on the ranch. And then, so now, you know, this following day here, hacking away at this deer, and she was right in front of me and blood splattering her all over. Anyway, getting off topic here. So the moral of the story is, if you have a good fence, you can potentially avoid the dirty work of having to put a deer out of its misery with a dull machete. So having good fencing is important. I've seen, I've even seen walls of cob used as a deer barrier. Reasons being, you know, some chose this in particular was to serve multiple uses, as it was also a way to practice building cob walls before building cob walls for a house. You know, it also increased the privacy of the area as well. But the most common type of fencing, though, and of which one Joel is a fan of, is electric fencing. You know, movable electric fencing. I've worked with them a lot, and they're quite easy to use. You know, they are light, easy to move around. And ideally, you'll use one strand electric fence if you're running cows, two strands with sheep, and three strands with goats. And when it comes to fencing or locating anything in general, Joel recommends that if anything ends up being in the same place for at least 3 years, leave it there and let it become permanent. An important point to remember is let function drive form. Next item of vital importance is water. We always got to be thinking about water. No water equals no life. You'll need to know where your source is. It could be a well, creek, spring, or pond. Remember, all water on or in the ground has came down from above your head at one point. So if you have no workable source to start out with, you still have plenty of options to capture and store on your site. Again, let your informed imagination go wild. Building ponds could be a great way to go. You know, this reminds me of visiting Tamara Eco Village in the desertifying region of Portugal, where they started with literally no water to be found. However, they had a guy named Sepp Holzer come to help with the design of a regenerative pond reservoir. And over the course of several years, the reservoir not only stayed permanently filled, but it raised up the local groundwater table of the whole bioregion. Even Joel mentions only a few things can possibly compare with a pond for bringing life back to where it's been struggling. When you build your pond, it needs to be located as high up on the landscape as possible in order to fully take advantage of the effects of gravity. Joel builds all of his, which he connects together with PVC piping, all being gravity fed, requiring no pumps or any kind of electricity. And if you're fortunate to have a high enough difference in elevation on your landscape, you can even generate your own power with a micro hydro station. I've experimented with this one myself in Panama, where the elevation difference was about 100 feet. And I wanted to see how cheap I'd be able to pull off a micro hydro station. And after many iterations, the resulting cost came down to about $400, of which the majority was spent on a permanent magnet alternator, which you could find in any car, really. So no matter if your climate is wet or brittle, you can never go wrong with having a pond which can hold up floodwaters and irrigate in dry times. Now, let's quickly mention having buildings. In short, we need to have a protected place to store tools, seeds, feedstocks, and such. You do not want to underestimate the need for buildings, but don't worry if you don't have much experience building before, because you know it could be fun and easy to learn natural building techniques like cob, adobe, or straw bale. An excellent first step, I think, is to start out with like a small tool shed or a fence wall, you know. And finally, we have to consider which vegetation within the given area needs to go. As Joel reminds us, we are the stewards of the land, and by working with the landscape, we are entering a dialogue. As caretakers, it's our job to keep precious sunlight from being wasted on disease and junky biomass. We need to secure the landscape for long-term and continued functionality, directing the process with intelligent, deliberate, and humble intellect. Okay, now that we've addressed the most crucial elements of infrastructure, layout, and landscape, let's now go ahead and dive into the other realm of success, which consists of the attitude and habits that Joel recommends to have in order to become thriving agricultural entrepreneurs. The way he puts it, one should cultivate an eclectic awareness, live frugally, and adopt a can-do entrepreneurial spirit. By eclectic awareness, this means that one's got to be well-rounded and educated in all walks of life, like leadership, spirituality, business, history, politics, etc. And a great shortcut for all of this is to read as often and as widely as you can. Thomas Jefferson, who champion the whole notion of the intellectual agrarian, has said, knowledge is power. Simply put, if you don't know, you can't make informed decisions. Here is what Joel recommends as a good reading regime to have. One, keep up to date with what's going on in your immediate vicinity. Read or listen to the local daily news because, as he puts it, your farming enterprise is not an island. Two, consume magazines related to your craft. If your thing is farming hemp, for example, soak in all the available material out there, like from the Hemp Business Journal, etc. And finally, read books. Joel affirms that if you want respect within your movement, read lots of books and many kinds. Read what the enemy says. If you're an integrity farmer, he says, then read Saving the Planet with Pesticides and Plastics by Dennis Avery. It also helps to quote directly from the source versus from somebody else's mouth from a distorted bias. But doing such things and reading up on leadership and business structure and the like, you'll be able to develop the depth and breadth necessary to be a professional in your vocation. Now, we'll go into the next thread of success being frugal living. Essentially, this is the sacrifice you'll have to make in order to make the dream a reality. Like grandma's old advice, a dollar saved is a dollar earned. Joel says, the reason why frugality gets a whole chapter in this book is because I've seen countless aspiring farmers and farm couples fail due to lifestyle and spending problems. And before I continue, I gotta say, what I enjoyed about this book is that he would explain himself a lot with numbers. Many great points were made just by laying out the math. So for this bit, he shows how spending $2,000 on an ATV to deliver eggs is a poor economic decision. Here's why. Because suppose you make the purchase and end up delivering about 10 dozen eggs per 250 days, totaling about 2,500 dozen eggs. The end result is that you made delivering a dozen of eggs $1 more costly, which is quite a lot considering how much one spends on a dozen of eggs these days. So basically the main idea is save for downtimes and don't spend unless it's an absolute necessity. The next thread of success is attitude, a can-do entrepreneurial spirit. It's important to hold a steadfast, affirmative attitude as you move forward, especially when all else seems to be pushing against you. And know this, the opposite of success is not failure. It's quitting. Winners get up one more time and they fall down. A good business classic writer, Peter Drucker, says, in any enterprise, you enter at a certain point with a certain amount of information and expectation, capital, and other resources, but then the curve goes down and not up. This valley, where our expectations change and we realize how ignorant we were, and when we use up all our capital and our friends abandon us, usually lasts 3 to 5 years, he says. Determination is the greatest asset a person can possess. Being the last guy standing often means you succeeded when others failed. Longevity can cover a multitude of errors. When you're going through the fire, time seems frozen, but looking back on it, you realize what a blimp in time and space that hardship really was, and that experience will build your confidence and affirm your belief in your own success. Joel reminds us in the book that hard times are not the problem. The problem is depression, frustration, and fear. And fear is a big one. Joel Salatin lays out what he believes to be the 7 deadly fears of starting a farming business. But have no fear of the fears. He immediately recommends the solutions for each one. So the first fear is knowledge, with questions like, well, how do I do this? What do I do first? Where do I start? Well, he says, start with what you like. Do the opposite of industrial anything. Start small. Start something. It could be anything. Good enough is perfect. If it's worth doing, it's worth doing poorly first. The second fear is acquiring land, with questions like, Well, how do we afford land? Where are we going to farm? How do we get a toehold? Well, one way is to start with a portable farm, he says. Fortunately, soil can be healed relatively quickly, and customers are portable. Piggyback by adding enterprises to existing farms and partner with those who already have land. The third fear is finances, with questions like, well, what happens when I don't get a paycheck from my off-farm job? Can we get up and running fast enough? What if we run out of money? Well, this first bit of advice is to be debt-free. Next, create a one-year nest egg to prepare for the worst-case scenario. Fill time with piecework, getting paid gigs like, you know, build a fence, paint, plant trees, teaching English online. You know, this is what I have relied on in downtimes. And create cash flow. Think multi-season complementary enterprises and consumables that people use up and have to buy over and over and over and over and over and over again. The fourth big fear is labor, with questions like, well, who will do all the work? What if we want to go away for the weekend? What if I get sick? How can I afford employees? How can I get it all done with only 24 hours in a day? Well, first things first, you gotta love people, because you won't be able to do it all yourself. Incentivize the team by creating commission-based partners and not having employees. Build collaborative, synergistic partnerships with others who have put their own skin in the game as well. And create community. Joel asserts that no farm is sustainable unless it has two salaries from two different generations. The fifth fear is marketing, with questions like, how do I get people interested? What if people reject me? Isn't greedy and selfish to hawk stuff? Well, here are some solutions. Diversify the portfolio. Use commission-based partners to help you sell. Gravitate more toward the electronic retail interface. Sell common, not exotic, products. For example, it's easier to sell chicken versus ostrich. The sixth fear is business, with questions like, isn't business evil? What if I make a profit? What about administration, accounting, insurance? Help! Bookkeepers and accountants are everywhere, so find them to help you out. Categorize everything in order to know your enterprise margins. Create benchmarks of efficiency and then put a value on different procedures. Stay in your unfair advantage. What do you do well, or what can you offer efficiently that others can't, won't, or aren't doing? Form an LLC to protect yourself from any kind of lawsuit. Joel says, profit is the lifeblood of sustainability, so don't apologize for it. And finally, the seventh and final fear is optimism, with questions like, how can I be excited about my farm business with corruption in Washington, climate change, the Kardashians all over the media? Isn't life in the pits? Don't I have to be pessimistic? How can I justify thinking big and enthusiastic when, you know, all collapse and ruin are on the horizon? Well, my friend, have a vision. It drives everything. I really like the question, if time and money were not an issue, what would you do tomorrow? Keep eye on the big missions and sacred causes. Faith eventually trumps fear. Write your vision and your mission and place it everywhere. The same with your action plan. Never give up. Now, to continue compounding your success, you gotta build up your tribe. Joel Salatin says, looking back, if there was one thing I could have done better, it would have been to build a team sooner. This inevitably means that it's important to be aware of common compatibility issues that may arise. And no matter how difficult and complex the social realm may be, Joel declares, this is where the secret of sustainability lies. When I went to Finhorn Eco Village in Scotland to study Eco Village design, I was surprised to find myself learning a lot more about conflict management and empathetic communication. One Eco Village expert told me, to master this line of work, one needs advanced training in sociology. So now we've covered the physical, emotional, social dimensions of having a successful farm business. Now, what's left to talk over now are the almighty business technicalities. We'll first look here at direct marketing, the why, where, and how. Basically, Joel says it's all about people. It's all about cutting out the middleman and establishing a direct relationship with your end user. It's about the community. Having somebody else do all your selling and distributing not only costs more, but it creates a disconnect. Joel says that becoming the middleman yourself is incredibly liberating and empowering and creates a community economy. And at the end of the day, will leave you feeling more emotionally supported. Additionally, in the book, Joel lays out the pros and cons for selling to each venue, including big supermarkets, small independent grocers, farmers markets, virtual farmers markets, restaurants, community-supported agriculture, food trucks, and having an on-farm store. Now, after reading what he says, you know, you'll get a better understanding of what would be best for you. And remember, it's all about making informed decisions. All in all, to really master this part of the game, Joel says, there are 8 pillars to master. 1, you need to have a diversified portfolio. Basically, the more one can buy from the same place, the more efficient they'll feel and the more loyal they'll become. The idea is to become a one-stop shop. 2, differentiation. You'll need to think about what's going to be the most distinctive thing about your farm and about your products. 3, you got to be customer friendly. You know, I really like the question, would you buy from you? Make sure to simplify as much as you can. 4, delivery is a separate business. Always separate your delivery charges from the product charges in order to simplify pricing as much as possible. Perhaps allow somebody else to do the delivery as a subcontractor. 5, think everyone food. Market food that most people already eat. It's far simpler than trying to get people to buy something with which they are completely unfamiliar with. 6, find your fit. Realize that you'll have to pick and choose among opportunities to find what works financially, emotionally, and logistically for you and your operation. 7, cash flow. Remember that most businesses do not fail to lack of service or product. They fail due to cash flow. So what can you sell every week? What do people buy every week? Maintaining market continuity is key. And 8, gateway products. How does a customer get in? Offering a cheap way in the door is key. Now, let's take a look at mastering gross margin analysis. This is all about the money coming in and going out and all the ratios in between. It's important to track everything. To put it simply, income minus direct costs equals enterprise gross margin. Now, in this chapter, Joel goes into incredible depth using plenty of examples with numbers. He stresses that most of one's outcome is determined by working on the business versus working in the business. You need to ask yourself, which option will give the greatest margin? And once you know your margin, you can set your price. But it all starts, he says, with good record keeping. Another element to being successful is to become a multi-enterprise. So just as nature develops polycultures, a successful farm develops poly-enterprises. Consequently, this helps to further diversify the farm itself, which in turn feeds the human spirit. Successful farmers need to have a multi-enterprise approach to their business. As discussed in marketing, this further helps to leverage customers who enjoy buying from a one-stop shop while at the same time leveraging a multi-use of the land base. So to provide an example of a multi-enterprise in action, Joel lists out everything that is currently being produced on his farm for sale. So here's the list he provides. You know, he's got beef, pork, chicken, turkey, rabbit, lamb, chicken eggs, duck eggs, pullets, honey, elderberry juice, maple syrup, school and corporate tours, seminars, lumber, firewood, vegetables, rustic wood products, burned etched wood signs, rough cut artisanal log butt slabs, books, t-shirts, postcards, seeds, handmade cosmetics, crocheted baby slippers. And now he's got even another list of what's currently in the works. And by the way, this is all good to get the ideas churning up in your own mind as you, find what most resonates with you or what would work most with you. So, you know, looking at his other potential ventures, you know, he's got now leather, fruit like apples, plums, mulberries, bramble fruits like blackberries, wreaths, flowers, fish, freshwater, crawdads, furniture, children's wooden toys, overnight accommodations, commercial kitchen like soups, stews, pot pies, stock, dairy like milk, cheese, kefir, and ice cream. I like this one. Fur accessories like mittens, gloves, and hats. Grapes, ferments like sauerkraut, kimchi, mushrooms, quail, waterfowl, and a food truck. And as tempting as it is to try everything at once, remember, start small, think modular. And once you have it, you know, the multi-enterprise farm will be the foundation upon which you build your community. So another bit of advice from Joel is to stay nimble. He describes that a nimble farm business is one that's long on ideas and relatively short on stuff. When you look at a lot of farms barely hanging in there, financially speaking, you'll see that by looking at current statistics, the average farm in America right now requires about $4 of depreciable infrastructure to generate $1 in annual gross sales. In other words, they depend too much on stuff. On Joel's farm, on the other hand, averages 50 cents to generate $1 of revenue, which is about 800% difference. So for those who want to follow his example, he lays out three strategies. The first one being what he calls mobile farms. There are plenty of options for farming nowadays without having to own any land, machinery, or buildings. The key, he says, is to be creative and explore all your options and to keep infrastructure mobile. This will also free you from being locked in. Next strategy is to be modular. And this entails taking your whole system and subdividing it into smaller parts. The way he explains it, you know, to start off small and then big and scale as big as you want, which also will have psychological benefits too, because you'd be able to measure your progress much easier. And finally, Joel recommends to be management intensive. And this is inherent with ecological farming in general. It just requires more labor, which is a good thing. You know, brings people out of the cities and back on the farms and back on the land. He says, rather than putting money into things, we're putting money into people. And this also provides more resiliency in the event of any collapse scenario, since growing, repairing, and building are the foundations of any economy. It's always advantageous to be friends with people who know how to grow things, build things, and fix things. So, in summary, the nibble farm can be placed anywhere at any scale. Finally, the next major last thread of success Joel teaches is time and motion studies, which simply means, in other words, business operations and how to achieve maximum efficiency. So he lays out three practical ways to achieve this. One, set benchmarks. How long should X activity take? Set accountability markers. You know, the most extreme example I can remember in regards to this was when I was working on an agroforestry farm in Uruguay with a German family, and they had their systems down to a T because, you know, we were, taking soil and putting them into pots, into seed growing pots. And, you know, he took me and he's like, no, put your elbows in and do it like this, you know, like very, very detailed oriented within the way the process was. And it made sense. I mean, it was just them two, and they had about 40 hectares. So acres, maybe, you know, a little under 100, and boy, they had their system flourishing. And it was only them two, but reason being, they were so efficient at, you know, what their process was, and it worked for them. You know, and I also grew up working with my dad in the moving business, and, you know, he would always say, don't ever come down the stairs or up the stairs without anything in your hands, boy. As movers, we had to learn how to be the most efficient working ants, you know, and in business and in pretty much anything, it's all about working smarter, not harder. Like one of the workers would always tell me, wheels, not heels, boy. But they didn't really talk like that. But anyway, Joel says, hard work is much more satisfying if we know is the right work and done as efficiently as possible. So there we have it. These are Joel's recommendations for how to have a successful agricultural business. He also finishes the book by giving even more tips on how to get started and all the new opportunities in farming too. But I'll save you those surprises because, like everything else we've covered, this material is dense. And I really like Joel Salatin's narrative. You know, he's a fun author to read and a great human being. So here are my questions for you to close out this summary. First question is, at what stage of your farming enterprise journey do you currently find yourself? And second question, and what does success in this journey look like for you? So thank you all for listening. Please share and leave your answers below, as it always helps to also meet like-minded others as well. Thanks for your support, much love, and God bless.